It's Tuesday, April 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, governments are scrambling to deal with revelations of massive hidden flows of money. Authorities work to shut off Islamic State oil. A controversial migrant transfer program begins in Europe. Also ahead, the 2016 Country Hall of Fame class is revealed. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Governments around the world are vowing to chase down the wealthy, powerful, and famous who set up offshore bank accounts to hide their assets and possibly evade taxes. The immediate reaction to a massive investigative journalist's report, known as the Panama Papers. The Kremlin denounced the disclosures, saying they were mostly aimed at Russian President Vladimir Putin, and claiming former U.S. State Department and Central Intelligence Agency officials helped analyze the 11.5 million documents leaked from Panama's Mossack Fonseca law firm. The report said Putin associates have funneled nearly $2 billion through offshore accounts over the years. Governments elsewhere scrambled to start investigations for possible tax evasion, with key political figures left to explain why they had created the offshore accounts named in the report by the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Shruti Shah, the anti-corruption campaign group Transparency International, says it's very easy to set up so-called shell companies in the United States, even though no U.S. names have yet come to light in the Panama Papers.
I think this is a pivotal moment for the United States to really show its leadership in the fight against secrecy and the fight against corruption. I absolutely think that it's not just Panama or the British Virgin Islands or all these tax havens where you can set up an anonymous shell company. You can do it right here at home in the United States. In any state in the U.S., you can form a company without disclosing who the beneficial owner is or who actually controls the company or derives economic benefits from the company.
Well, let's talk about the three items that Transparency International has asked for. All countries should require much higher levels of transparency about who owns and controls companies registered within their territories. How would they go about doing that?
One way to do it is to establish really a register to collect the beneficial ownership information when a company is formed upon incorporation. So in the U.S., for example, incorporation is done at the state level. So we'd ideally want states to collect this information as soon as the company is formed. In a perfect world, this information should be publicly available because it will help law enforcement journalists and, you know, ordinary citizens to know who's behind the companies that they are investing in or that they are buying for or they're doing business with.
The second point, professional enablers that are found to be complicit in corruption must be sanctioned. This sounds to me like tougher laws.
You're absolutely right. Now, before they can be sanctioned, we really do need laws which require gatekeepers such as those in the real estate industry to do due diligence on who is actually buying expensive real estate and if it's bought through an anonymous shell company, and really figure out the buyers' identities and the sources of their funds. That's actually really needed. I mean, they have to be required to do some due diligence on all, you know, all the secrets.
And the third point, all countries should require any company bidding for public contracts or purchasing property to disclose on whose behalf that they're operating.
So let me give you an example based right here in the United States. If, say, you want to do business with the federal government and, you know, you want to apply for the federal government contract or a grant, you're not required to disclose who your beneficial owner is. And, in fact, it makes it more difficult for suspension and debarment officers to enforce their list. Say, if I did something wrong and they sanctioned me, I could just go and set up another company without disclosing that I'm behind the company and go and do business with the government again. And that has happened. So if you're doing business with the government, it is a privilege. It is taxpayers' money, and the government has to safeguard it. It is crucial that they collect this information from all bidders for public contracts.
The article on your website notes that in May, the UK will be hosting a global anti-corruption summit with world leaders, and this seems like a golden opportunity to start addressing this kind of thing, especially in light of what has been revealed.
And, in fact, even before this was disclosed, the key theme of the summit was going to be around ending safe havens for the corrupt all around the world and tackling the secrecy around anonymous companies, as, you know, David Cameron had indicated before. So now with this massive leak, it becomes all the more urgent to tackle this issue.
With countries involved in this summit that contain leaders or politicians who have been involved in some of these offshore dealings, how probable is it that a gathering like that would actually create something substantive?
So, you know, that is a billion-dollar question, and it's up to people like us, civil society, ordinary citizens, and journalists like you to keep the pressure going. We actually have to see a change in the way business is done. And this massive leak really proves the urgency of the situation and why it's important to act right now.
Shruti Shah is Vice President of Programs and Operations at Transparency International USA. Shruti, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Turning to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to bring us what's trending online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Who are you following today?
I'm following a reporter with the Süddeutsche Zeitung. His name is Bastian Obermeier, and his handle is @B_Obermeier. One of his earlier tweets about the project reads like this. Hello, this is John Doe. Interested in data, I'm happy to share. This is how it started more than a year ago. #PanamaPapers, #CraziestYearEver.
Wow. How many followers does he have?
More than 3,300, so not too shabby at all. Jim, this story really got me thinking about the global cooperation among journalists. And here are some of the news outlets that cooperated. The ICIJ, of course, but the BBC, the Namibian, the AP, McClatchy, and the Korea Center for Investigative Journalism all contributed.
You tweeted a poll yesterday asking people about their thoughts on the absence of American names in the paper. What was the result?
More than half of the respondents answered, "That's just a reflection of the reality in which the U.S. is less corrupt than the countries mentioned in the paper." That being said, though, there is a development from the Justice Department. Both The Hill and CNN tweeted, "The DOJ announced it is reviewing Panama Papers for possible financial wrongdoing."
We'll definitely have to see what the verdict is, but the biggest political commotion is probably in Iceland, right?
Absolutely. Thousands of people protested outside its parliament, calling on the prime minister to resign. There are photos and clips of the protests all over social media. That's because a Panama paper showed the prime minister and his wife allegedly owned bonds issued by the country's three largest banks through an offshore company. Jim?
Thank you for the update, G. You may follow her on Twitter anytime you like at G. Abby Lee. I also post there many times daily as well at VOA Stevenson. And we invite you, as always, to follow the International Edition stream. You'll find that at VOA_IE. Involved in secretive and illegal transfers of big money are groups like Islamic State, which has used oil production from large fields it has captured to generate income by selling oil. Some of that oil has found its way to the United States and into the tanks of everyday vehicles. International Business Times Middle East reporter Aaron Banko tracked one such shipment and joins us with more details on the difficult task authorities have to stop the flow.
What's interesting about this story is that, you know, we've heard about ISIS oil for a really long time since ISIS came to power, right? A lot of people have talked about how many barrels a day they produce, how much money it produces. It's very, very difficult to put a number on it. And I think from, you know, my investigation and having been on the ground for the past 2 years in and out of Iraq and in parts of Syria, I can tell that these operations are not happening in broad daylight. It's very, very difficult to track for even for the security officials that are tracking it. And I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done on this. And I think it's a really important subject, especially when we're talking about cutting off ISIS financially from the global market, from the international market, and not allowing the terrorist group to sort of spread north into Europe.
Islamic State generates a lot of its revenues from the sale of oil. Some of it has found its way here to the United States, as you have found out. What are some of the ways that it's getting here?
The first year or so that ISIS took over a lot of land in Iraq and Syria, they took hold of pretty major oil fields in eastern Syria and western Iraq. And what ended up happening was that once they bulldozed the border between Syria and Iraq back in June 2014, they were able to truck a lot of the oil that they had garnered in eastern Syria and move it into Iraq. and move it into an area of Iraq that serviced exports. So there were two ways, trucking and pipeline.
So, of course, being oil, it's not like it's something that has a serial number or you can figure out where it came from. Once it gets into those pipelines, then it's pretty much just a commodity, correct?
Correct. The batch of oil that we were looking at was a batch of oil that was lifted in northeast Iraq, and it was actually a batch of oil that was trucked from that area to the port of Dorotgil in Turkey and then shipped out through that port to the Delaware River outside of Philadelphia, where it was then transferred to a refinery and then sort of distributed up and down the eastern seaboard.
The State Department described the sale of Islamic State oil as a drop in the bucket. How much are we talking about, and how much effect has it really had on the oil market?
In the spring of 2014, before ISIS took Mosul in June, we were talking about probably 15% of its total production, daily production, was making its way onto the international market. Most of it, the oil that it was extracting and producing, was sold domestically. You know, in terms of impact, it's very hard to measure impact in this case because their territory was shifting daily and nobody was on the ground tracking any of this. But it definitely happened at a time when ISIS was, you know, recruiting tens of thousands of people, and they had to recruit them with financial, you know, sort of promises.
As terrorist groups are attacked, often tactics change. Has Islamic State changed its tactics in the ways that it gets oil out?
It has. The group's gotten a lot better at really scaling down its oil operations and dispersing it. And what I mean by that is they're no longer tapping into very big oil fields that are huge targets, mostly because they don't have access to that territory anymore. They are still in control of two or three oil fields in western Iraq and a bunch in eastern Syria. So it's not like they don't have any oil, but I think most of it is being distributed domestically these days.
Erin Banko is an International Business Times Middle East reporter. Her article is How ISIS Oil Ended Up on U.S. Streets. Erin, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much.
This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The first migrants have been returned to Turkish ports from Greek islands Monday under a controversial plan worked out between the European Union and Turkey to ease Europe's migration crisis. Under the deal, those who reached Greece after March 20th and don't qualify for asylum are to be sent back to Turkey. For each migrant returned, Turkey will send a Syrian to the European Union and receive additional EU funding, visa-free European travel for its citizens, and progress on its EU membership. Turkey is caring for millions of Syrians escaping the conflict in their country. VOA's Luis Ramirez on the Greek island of Lesbos watched the pre-dawn darkness Monday of the first ferry leaving that island, and then he spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
It was done in a very discreet way, no access given to the media. No one got to see the actual boarding of the ferry. What we saw were buses pull up to the port, load onto a ferry bound for Turkey. This is the first of the deportations under the deal announced by the European Union and Turkey 2 weeks ago.
This deal is very controversial. Rights groups have raised concerns about whether or not it's legal or ethical. We're talking about just a matter of several hundred people. This is really just a small drip in an ocean of migrants that have made their way to Europe?
Well, the deal calls for a trade, one for one. That is, for every refugee, every migrant that Turkey takes back, it agrees to send one Syrian refugee who is eligible for asylum to the European Union. This was meant as a measure to relieve the pressure on Greece. There are thousands of migrants who have found their way to Greek shores, about 3,000 currently on this small island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea. The plan is to relieve that pressure, to show citizens in Europe that the governments are doing something to relieve the migrant crisis, but at the same time drawing a great deal of criticism from humanitarian groups who say that Turkey, with its bad human rights record, is not the place to be sending them. They argue that these people should instead be integrated into the European Union.
Well, as you know, the mainland of Greece is hosting tens of thousands of other refugees and migrants, and they're being denied access to the Balkans by countries like Macedonia, who have closed their borders.
It's a very different scenario from when I first started covering the migrant crisis back in September. At that point, German Chancellor Angela Merkel had said that Europe welcomed these people, called for nations to accept 160,000 of them. There was a pretty big backlash, some countries just plain ignoring that call. And in the end, today, really only about 1,100 people have been absorbed into Europe. And so what we saw after the first very huge wave of migrants was countries suddenly clamping down. And we're talking about not only the countries of Eastern Europe that from the very beginning said they would not take a single migrant. We're talking about countries like Sweden, which have historically been welcoming. They suddenly shut their doors and said they will accept only the bare minimums established by the European Union.
VOA's Luis Ramirez. Europe is reeling under an influx of migrants and refugees fleeing not only Syria, but streaming in front from South Asia and Africa. More than 1 million reached Europe last year alone. Here in the United States, stocks closed slightly lower Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 0.3%. And for more on what's behind that drop and what investors are looking forward to later this week, VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino.
I think what's really driving the market is we've had a six-week run, which is quite astounding, and it is time for a little bit of corrective action. Oil has been down itself about 6% from the highs, so you're going to see a little bit of a pullback from there. Earlier in the morning, we saw the industrials down. There was a downgrade out of Bernstein on General Electric. So anytime you get a downgrade of a big international conglomerate, clearly a Dow component, you're going to see some pressure in the market for that reason. So I don't think it's anything to get nervous about that the market's falling significantly. It's just some corrective action off of an incredible six-week run that we've seen.
Well, why are investors going to be watching the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen and her colleagues this week?
When monetary policy is more accommodative, more easy, it means that the Federal Reserve is willing to invest money back into the markets, which keeps asset prices supportive, which was why we've seen assets such as stocks, which are considered risk-on assets, move higher. The reason why we're going to look at Chairman Yellen this week, and she has six other colleagues speaking, is investors and traders want to get a clue to see if they can pick up anything at their speaking engagements, whether or not they're going to keep this dovish tone in monetary policy, or if there's anyone that's saying it's time to raise interest rates at this point, because those kinds of comments will certainly drive headlines and in turn move the markets.
Jill Malandrino, our financial reporter in New York, thanks for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi,
I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Country Hall of Fame class of 2016 was recently announced. This year, three new members will be inducted into music's most exclusive club: Randy Travis, Charlie Daniels, and Fred Foster. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to shed light on each of their legacies.
Nikki, let's start with Randy Travis. He was inducted in the Modern Era category.
Yes. Now, in the Country Music Hall of Fame, in order to be eligible as the Modern Era inductee, you have to have at least 20 years of success after achieving national prominence. And Randy Travis definitely delivers. So since the 1980s, he's recorded 20 studio albums. He's celebrated 16 number one songs, charted more than 50 singles, has sold more than 25 million albums, including gospel music as well. And in his acting career, he scored more than 40 motion picture and television roles. And Travis has also received 10 AMA awards, 8 Dove awards, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But in addition to all of that, when Randy broke out with his 1980s album, Storms of Life, it helped change the country music sonic landscape. He helped usher in what is called the neo-traditional country movement of the 80s. So it developed in contrast to many of the pop country acts at the time, like Ann Murray, and the rise of what was called, quote-unquote, the urban cowboy fad, which was informed by the John Travolta movie of the same title at that time. So the neo-traditional movement drew inspiration from the elders of country music, like Hank Williams and Ernest Tubb and Kitty Wells, so a little more honky-tonk and bluegrass. It also blended old-school instrumentation with contemporary production, which is why they called it neo-traditional. It also came with this whole stage presence that included wearing clothes that many country icons wore in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And Randy Travis said at one point he was turned down by every label for being quote-unquote too country. But I know, could you imagine? But there apparently was a craving in that market for that too country sound. And this neo-traditional movement he helped foster still thrives today alongside its country pop and country rock siblings.
Now, he's also recovering from a stroke.
Yeah. Back in 2013, he had a stroke. That makes this honor much more piercing. His wife at the announcement ceremony said that the doctors told her to pull a plug on him and say goodbye. And she says she took his hand and said, "I need a little more fight from you, baby." And she said that she knew he had a talk with Jesus because he squeezed her hand and a tear fell down her face. And here he is now, and he's still undergoing speech therapy.
Well, now, okay, tell us about Charlie Daniels. He was inducted into the Veteran Era category.
Yeah, he's a veteran, so you have to have 40 years of skin in the game after achieving national prominence to be inducted into this category. So this is quite an accomplishment, too. Charlie Daniels, he's a singer, he's a songwriter, he's a guitarist, he's a fiddler. He's known for his contributions to country and bluegrass and southern rock music. Many know him from his number one hit, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. He actually won the Grammy Award for Best Country Vocal Performance for that song, which experienced major crossover success. I think even now it is on the video game Guitar Hero 3, Legends of Rock. So wow. Perhaps people's grandchildren know the song and are learning to play it. So he's also written and played songs for many other artists as well. He co-wrote It Hurts Me, which Elvis recorded. As a session musician in Nashville, he played electric bass on 3 of Bob Dylan's albums. In 2014, he actually released a tribute to the music of Bob Dylan. His singles have consistently charted and received airplay. He was inducted into the Grand Ole Opry back in 2008, and he is still very active recording and performing today. So Charlie has done his time, and it's great that he is being recognized for his work.
In the non-performer category, you have Fred Foster. Tell us about him.
Fred Foster. Now, upon hearing the news of being honored, he was like, "This is a joke, right?" But Fred is really no joke. He is a music-loving entrepreneur. He worked his way up to national country promotion at Mercury Records, then worked at ABC Paramount, and then started his own label, very successful label called Monument Records and publishing company Combine Music, through which he launched the careers of Dolly Parton, and also played a vital role in the careers of Kris Kristofferson and Roy Orbison. He produced many of Orbison's major hits, including Oh Pretty Woman, Only the Lonely, Running Scared, Candyman, Blue Bayou, and that's just a short list. He also produced recordings by Billy Grammer, Roger Miller, Ray Stevens, Larry Gatlin, Charlie McCoy, Jerry Bird, to name a few.
Wow, very impressive.
Yes, it is extensive. His work with Willie Nelson earned a Grammy. He's also expanded his label to include a soul and R&B imprint called Soundstage 7. And artists on that soul imprint included Ivory Joe Hunter, Joe Simon, and Arthur Alexander.
Well, the official 2016 Country Hall of Fame induction ceremony takes place at the Country Music Hall of Fame later this year. You can hear more country music from Randy Travis, Charlie Daniels, Fred Foster, and more on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold.
And we'd like to squeeze in this one piece of breaking news. Villanova University has defeated North Carolina 77-74 to win the national championship of men's college basketball, Villanova's second title, the first back in 1985. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us and hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State named 14 reformers and civil society activists as recipients of the 2016 International Women of Courage Award. They included women from nations across the globe, from Mauritania to Malaysia and beyond. 13 accepted the award personally from Secretary of State John Kerry, who called the awardees role models whose lives convey a clear message. Don't accept the unacceptable or wait for someone else to step up. Act in the name of justice. But as the 13 honorees sat on the dais at the State Department, Chinese honoree Ni Ulan was absent. Ni Ulan, a human rights defender, is known for her work in championing housing rights and freedom of religion. For her efforts, she has been subjected to harassment, imprisonment, and torture. Although she was not allowed to travel to the United States to receive her award, Secretary of State Kerry praised Ni Ulan in absentia.
Her outspokenness has led her to imprisonment, during which she was beaten so badly that she became paralyzed from the waist down. But that hasn't stopped her. She continues to defend the property rights of Beijing residents whose homes have been slated for demolition. And she has launched the Ni Ulan Human Rights Office to connect activists and lawyers across China to advance the cause of justice. Ni Ulan, for your leadership in advocating for the rule of law and full equal rights in China, we honor you today as a woman of courage.
The Chinese government's treatment of Ni Ulan is part of a concerning pattern of its targeting human rights defenders and civil society activists in China for reprisal. As U.S. Ambassador to China Max Baucus has said, the lawyers who bravely fight for the legal rights of religious believers, journalists, victims of forced evictions, should be embraced as partners, not enemies of the government. Secretary Kerry has observed, strong respect for human rights actually unleashes a country's potential and helps to advance growth and progress. That's a powerful reason why governments should celebrate and not thwart the work of courageous human rights defenders like Ni Ulan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is.